From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working with students and families to improve college access and student success for a better West Virginia.
Good evening, I'm Andrea Lanham. At the legislature today, a massive reorganization bill was introduced in the House of Delegates that would divide the Department of Health and Human Resources into four separate agencies. The DHHR is currently comprised of the Bureau for Children and Families, the Bureau for Child Support Enforcement, the Bureau for Public Health, the Bureau for Medical Services, the Bureau for Behavioral Health and Health Facilities, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, with many, many programs under each of those bureaus. These services are staffed by about 6,000 employees and serve our most vulnerable populations. Joining me tonight is Mr. Bill Crouch, Health and Human Resources Cabinet Secretary. Secretary Crouch, thank you for joining me tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to get into this proposed reorganization in just a minute, but we're taking questions this session from viewers in a segment called I'd Like to Know and Providing Answers. And we will have one which you, Secretary Crouch, will want to respond to as well. So we begin with a question about Child Protective Services and a DHHR reorganization.
Hi, my name is Sam Hickman. I'm from Charleston, West Virginia. And I'd like to know how the legislature is going to make sure we can protect our most vulnerable citizens, our children, from abuse and neglect. Our child welfare system is overwhelmed by the number of children who are being removed from homes due to abuse and neglect because of the opioid crisis. We don't have enough child protective service workers to meet that need. We have a terrible problem keeping them because of the low pay that they receive. And I need to know what our investment is going to be in our children so that they have a future in West Virginia.
The problem that Mr. Hickman raised is one that I am very, very worried about. We were told in our committee that the number of foster care cases where children were being removed from the home had gone up from 4,000 to 6,000. That's a 50% increase. And I'm sure that we have not increased the number of child protective service workers. He's correct, the pay is low, the turnover is enormous. There are so many cases that they've been assigned to that they can't do their job in the way they would like to do it. We really need to direct more resources there. Another complication that I worry about is there is a proposal to reorganize the Department of Health and Human Resources and break it up into four parts, four separate agencies, each with their own secretary. That might be a good idea. I'm not sure if it's a good idea, but I think right now, it's a terrible idea. We need all hands on deck to deal with this issue because families are having a hard time. We have great grandparents trying to raise their great grandchildren, and we need social workers to help them to navigate the system and to make sure those kids are safe and that they don't get into the cycle of abuse and poverty like maybe their parents have landed into.
Joining us again, Bill Crouch, Secretary of Health and Human Resources. So, two main points in that segment. Let's start with the first, that we have a child welfare and foster care crisis in West Virginia. Advocacy groups say that children are being neglected, we need more resources, we need more social workers, and you've also had millions cut to your budget over the last several years. And while that's been taken away, the need for social services has only risen. Is there a crisis in child protective services?
It's a serious, serious problem, and both of those individuals were directly on target with regard to the extent of the problem. West Virginia is number one in the nation with regard to the children taken from the home on a per capita basis. 83% of our children in foster care are from families whose mother has overdosed or is addicted to drugs. We have a critical problem here with Child Protective Services. I learned of this problem probably late last summer. It's taken a while to really determine the extent of the problem and how to fix this problem. I'm in the middle of a plan to take vacant positions along with the dollars with those positions and place those into counties to increase the number of Child Protective Service workers in West Virginia for those counties where caseloads are above 15 per CPS worker. We have some counties where the caseloads are at 30%, 30 cases and above, which it's an overburden on these individuals. The people who stay there and do this work are our core staff who really care about these kids and they want to take care of these kids, and they stay in spite of this terrific caseload they have. The other area that wasn't mentioned here that's a concern are the courts. And we're burdening the courts with cases, and we're not able to stand in front of a judge and say, here are the details of this case. Here's the information that you need, judge, to make a decision. So we've got to get that caseload down where the individuals have enough time to work a case and determine what needs to be done. We've got to take care of our kids here.
And you said 83% of children removed are coming from homes with substance abuse?
83% of the children in foster homes are from families whose mother has had drug problems.
So what's your plan to address that?
We're trying to get more foster care families. The comment was made that grandparents are raising children. We have a huge number of parents and external family members raising children in West Virginia because of this problem. We're trying to get more foster parents, foster families. That's difficult to do, and that's why we have extended families now taking care of these children. But we're working hard on that, going out into communities and trying to get more foster families out there. We need to probably reduce those barriers a little bit. I think over time there have been a lot of, in terms of safety of the children, a lot of things that have been put in place that we're looking at right now to determine whether we need to make kind of entry into the foster program a little easier.
And what are you asking lawmakers to do to help remove some of these barriers?
Well, we're looking at regulations right now. In fact, I think some of the lawmakers are also looking at the regulations to see whether we need to eliminate some of those requirements. So they've had those discussions with us, and I think together with the legislature, we will end up trying to reduce those or reducing those somewhat.
Do you think that you're sounding the alarm loud enough? Do you think that lawmakers who are making these budget decisions right now, are they being reminded strongly enough about the multiple crises that the DHHR is facing?
I think so. I just left finance subcommittee meeting, and this is one of the very things we talked about in that meeting was the critical nature of this problem. And there was a great deal of interest with regard to the legislators in there, Chairman Ellington especially, to help fix these problems. And I was specifically asked, is there anything we can do to help with this problem? So I think we're working together to get a resolution to this. We're gonna add at least 45 new CPS workers, 45 positions in those counties that are really overburdened. Again, if we can get the caseload down to 15 per caseworker right now, that's our goal immediately. Eventually, we probably need to get that caseload down to 12 to 14 or so.
So is this an additional appropriation from the legislature?
It is not. I am going to pull existing vacant positions throughout DHHR and reallocate those positions to this program, to this purpose.
Now, according to information we've requested from the DHHR regarding the governor's budget, there's about $8 million more allotted for social services, including foster care. However, these monies are taken from other accounts, some from Medicaid, some from other programs. So it doesn't look like it's new money. It looks like it's shifting money. Some would say you're robbing Peter to pay Paul and that you should be lobbying for additional money.
We've actually done extremely well with our budget. We have reduced our budget the last 2 years. I've been here 1 year. The last legislative session, I was here 30 days before I came into the halls and into these meetings. Even then, last year, we reduced our request by $20 million. We are actually putting money back into the general revenue fund from DHHR this year. We have two specific areas that we were able to reduce with regard to our budget by a total of $130 million. So part of that money is going back into DHHR to help with this problem and other problems. So it is reallocating money, but we're not taking money away from services.
I know a lot of advocacy groups are saying that there's not enough money in the system right now.
Well, you could argue there's never enough money in the system. We need to be more efficient, and we need to be smarter about what we do and how we do it. We have duplication in DHHR, and I'm looking to eliminate some of that duplication. We have children's programs that are through our Bureau of Children and Families, and we have children's programs through CHIPS. And Medicaid pays for some of those, and doesn't pay for others. State funds pays for other. I'm trying to get those reorganized so that we're eliminating some of that duplication and saving money. The more state money we can use to match federal money, which is on average a 75% match in round numbers, the less state money it takes to do that. So we're using more and more of our monies to match federal money so that we really take advantage of that.
So let's talk about the opioid epidemic's impact on everything that you try to do in the DHHR's opioid response plan. What is the battle plan?
I believe where we're at right now, and I will say for the again, this is my second session in this position, and I'm already seeing a lot more interest and activity in solving this drug problem together. The governor has two bills. He has asked that this be a priority, and we're making it a priority. It is, we have to turn a corner on this problem. So the two bills, the two main bills that are in the legislature are the governor's bills, and they're very involved and active in making changes that we think are appropriate and necessary to solve this problem. I believe where we're at right now is in the treatment phase. We need to really move hard into the treatment phase. The Ryan Brown Fund last year, which legislature approved, allowed us to put out almost $21 million in funds for additional treatment beds in this state. That's going to result in over 300 additional beds spread out through West Virginia. What we need now, and I've said for months and months, this has to be solved at the local level. I can talk, the governor can talk, legislators can talk about the drug problem. It really is at the local level that we have to challenge folks and help folks put together things like the quick response teams who can go out and after an overdose, work very hard to get people into treatment immediately. So we're gonna move very hard these next few months to get this treatment piece together, and hopefully with all the changes that are coming together here, I think we hopefully will start to see a change, a leveling off of this problem.
Let's talk about the DHHR reorganization. I know that bill came up in the House today, and the comment from Delegate Fleshauer, who is a 21-year veteran of the Health and Human Resources Committee, was restructuring the DHHR. Now is not a good time for that. Do you agree with her?
I've been here a year. I've told all of our folks that to not get defensive. Let's look and see what's provided and projected and suggested in this bill. It's a 500-page bill. I have not read the bill yet. We were invited to two meetings where we answered questions about what would occur if they did made certain changes in certain departments to set up separate departments in government. As a result of that, there were some changes. Again, I have not read the bill. If I had to guess, I have said, I spent 30 years in the private sector helping hospitals merge and nursing homes merge. We watched banks merge, pharmacies merge. The whole idea behind those kinds of arrangements are to reduce overhead. So to think you're going to take one department and set up four and not increase overhead is not logical. If I had to guess, this bill will cost millions of dollars. From my standpoint, I've tried not to be defensive about this, and I'm willing to look at anything. I'm told, you know, this department is too large to manage, it needs to be broken up. I simply don't understand that. There are states three or four times larger than West Virginia with similar structures. So I'm not sure where that comes from. We've tried to be open with the legislature and will continue to provide any information they want, any data that they want, and we're trying to increase the amount of information we give them, make all of our bureau commissioners available for any meeting, any committee meeting, to talk to them and answer questions. So. I'm not sure what's gained by that, but clearly someone believes that we need to be smaller.
I know too that the four new entities that's created from this is going to have four commissioners that are moving up to secretaries, and that's going to affect the cost as well.
There are a lot of costs, hidden costs to this. Again, if we, for example, we have three people in the department that, and our budget is $5.7 billion, and we have three people that handle cash. If you separate this department into four, you're still going to have two people to handle cash for each of those departments. That's just one example of how you can't just divide the department into four pieces and expect our IT department, our HR department, our finance department to split those people up and think we have the ability to just keep going without making significant changes. We're looking at the impact and trying to seriously look at the cost of this, assuming there will be a request for a fiscal note. I can't imagine it cannot cost millions of dollars to the state to do this. So again, I'm not clear on the benefits of this at this point.
Now, Medicaid drug tests, there's work requirements. What research suggests these incentives work?
Well, we had these, of course, we're not the first state to do this. So there are other states that have shown benefits from this. There are individuals who, on the work requirements, who are able to work and can work. And one of the things we try to do in the department is get people back to work. We're not trying to hurt people. We're not trying to make people do things that are inappropriate. But as we get people back to work, there are less people on the program. Just as if we get people off of drugs, people don't need our services as much. So we really look to get people back into the job market and become a viable part of their community. And we look at DHHR as being a resource and a safety net, and to help those individuals who really need our services. And we're going to continue to do that.
Now, last year, selling state-owned psychiatric facilities came up during the session. Is there going to be a push this session for that as well?
Actually, what came up last year was a move to privatize the long-term care facilities. We have seven facilities in West Virginia. Four are long-term care facilities. They're called hospitals, mostly because many of those started as TB hospitals years and years ago. Most of the four that I was looking to privatize are considered long-term care facilities. But these are long-term care facilities that take care of individuals that really have no other source of care out there. The private long-term care industry does not take care of these individuals. They may be individuals that are geriatric combative patients, geriatric psych patients, individuals that the private sector is not staffed for, not capable of taking care of. So this year, I have not made that a priority. I have looked to the drug problem and the CPS problem. The more that we learned about that and the more that evolved, those are my two top priorities for this year.
Well, Secretary Crouch, thank you again for being here tonight. There's obviously so much to talk about with DHHR's issues.
Yes, thank you for having me.
House and Senate lawmakers introduced 28 joint resolutions in just the first week of the legislative session, each calling for amendments to the state constitution. Some are similar or related, and the legislature is unlikely to approve them all. But Dave Mistich takes a look at proposed constitutional amendments that are gaining traction rather early in the session, and which ones voters may see very, very soon on the ballot in November.
Long before the legislature convened for the 2018 regular session, discussions surrounding a constitutional amendment that could repeal the state's business inventory tax had already begun among House and Senate leaders, as well as Governor Jim Justice's office. That tax, which has brought in on average about $140 million in revenue annually over the past 10 years, provides money that helps fund counties, particularly public education. Republicans argue that the tax makes it harder to attract businesses in the state, and cite studies done by previous administrations that have called for its repeal. Some Democrats have questioned the measures as far as the long-term fiscal shape of the state, but are open to the idea, as long as county funding remains intact. Senate Minority Whip Corey Palumbo is one of those Democrats.
I think there'll be several people who will support that as long as, you know, the counties are made whole and don't lose money as a result of it. And you know, a lot of that money goes to education. So, I mean, we don't want to defund public education. The question is whether there's going to be enough money to make sure the counties are still okay.
Following reports last year, the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals lavished spending on furniture and other office decorations. Lawmakers are also considering various resolutions that could place the judicial branch's budget under the legislature's review. This also would take a vote from the public to ratify an amendment to the state's constitution. Delegate Michael Folk has introduced one of many measures that would address the matter.
There's been a lot of rumblings around that for years, but nobody wanted to step on the Supreme Court's toes. But we're the only state that doesn't have some type of oversight of their budget, of the Supreme Court's budget.
During budget hearings in front of House and Senate Finance Committees, Supreme Court Chief Justice Alan Laufrey referred to the reports of high-dollar spending as, quote, isolated, and promises moving forward he'll make sure it doesn't happen again.
The Chief Justice's remarks as far as not being aware of some of the overspending is not a good argument because, you know, obviously, if he's not aware of it and they have full authority over their budget, then maybe we should have oversight and we should let the citizens decide at the ballot box on whether this constitutional amendment should pass.
Another issue gaining traction would call for the restructuring of the State Board of Education. A resolution in the Senate would allow the legislature to pass laws to control the structure of the board. Over in the House, HJR 103, a resolution with more specific language, would give the legislature oversight of the Board of Education's rulemaking process. It also calls for the board to be reduced to 9 members, 6 of whom would be elected and 3 appointed by the governor. Currently, the governor appoints 9 of the board's 12 members, with the remaining 3 non-voting ex officio members who respectively serve in the role of State Superintendent of Schools, Chancellor of the West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, and Chancellor of the Community and Technical College Education System. Delegate Paul Espinosa is sponsoring the resolution that could bring about these changes. He outlined how the election of board members might be broken up.
My preference would be to establish, you know, relatively small districts around the state so that you have equal representation around the state. I know in the Eastern Panhandle, for example, which is the area of the state that I represent, you know, we've had representatives on the state school board from time to time, but it hasn't been very consistent. It would be my hope that by electing 6 of those state school board members, you could ensure that you have representation from around the state.
Those opposed to the measure, including the West Virginia chapter of the American Federation of Teachers, argue that the influence of money could give educators a lesser chance of serving and muddy the functions of the board with politics. Another issue gaining early traction is abortion. While not yet formally introduced this session, many rumblings around the Capitol indicate a resolution is coming that could limit or possibly end taxpayer-funded abortions through Medicaid. Delegate Barbara Fleshauer, a Democrat, has concerns about the motivation for such a measure.
So I just worry that, you know, one of the ideas that's floating around, it's being done for electioneering purposes to draw out the ballot, that these are things that they think would excite the base of the majority party. So I worry about that, but, you know, we're going to deal with things on a, you know, on a topic by topic basis and try to be objective.
With so many constitutional amendments being discussed and garnering so much attention, many lawmakers point out that citizens should be reminded that they would have the final say on any of these issues under the legislature's consideration. Senate Judiciary Chair Charlie Trump says they're keeping this in mind, particularly the language used that would inevitably translate to the ballot.
For some constitutional amendments, it's impossible to print the entire text of the amendment on a ballot. So it is important that the ballot is worded in such a fashion that the people do understand what the effect of its ratification would be.
As for the number of resolutions currently being discussed, Trump says he has full faith that the voting public will be able to make sense of each measure.
Well, I don't worry about the voters being confused. I think we make a mistake anytime we underestimate the citizens of the state. It is, after all, their constitution, and we are all bound by it in whatever it says, and the citizens have the right, retain the right, to direct what the Constitution will say and provide.
Resolutions calling for constitutional amendments require a two-thirds majority of both chambers of the legislature and the governor's signature before going to a vote of ratification by the general public via a ballot measure. For the Legislature Today, I'm Dave Mistich at the Capitol.
That will wrap things up for us this evening. Tomorrow night, I'll be joined by State House reporters who will help us catch up on all the action that has taken place this week and preview what's on the calendar for next week. I'm Andrea Lanham for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us for the Legislature Today. We'll see you tomorrow night. My